In honor of his wedding to Hera, Zeus put out a challenge, seeking the best and most original wedding meal. The winner could ask for any favor from the king of the gods. Many came before Zeus with disappointing meals, until a modest nymph offered up a plain bowl full of golden gloop. It was the most magnificent thing Zeus had ever tasted, and he at once proclaimed it the nectar of the gods, granting immortality to all who consumed it. The nymph, named Melissa, asked Zeus for help making honey, so he granted her a colony of bees and made her queen. But when she asked for a lethal weapon to defend the colony, Zeus was incensed, so he granted her request with a curse. This new weapon would cause pain to its victims, but would be lethal for the bees who used it. Norse mythology also reveres honey, but instead of immortality, their honeyed wine offers the gift of poetry and eloquence. Still, we can all agree on one thing. Honey is divine. I'm Ed Ronco. This week on the Up North Lowdown, our story of bees. It is comparatively pedestrian, but no less important. We're going to learn how they interact with Northern Michigan's ecosystem and where they come from. We'll also hear about the regional history of barn architecture, plus a related road trip you might enjoy. We are starting, though, with electricity. It has been about a month since the ice storm hit northern Michigan. Yes, the ice storm. It was a big deal. We've told you before about how trees snapped and came down on power lines and how more than 100,000 people were in the dark for a really long time. But there's a new wrinkle. The very same stuff that knocked the power out a few weeks ago could now be used to make electricity. IPR climate reporter Izzy Ross explains.
At a giant dirt lot off a side road in Emmett County, the air smells sharply of pine. Enormous piles of logs and branches three times my height sit around the property. Terry and Nancy Chamberlain are dragging pine branches out of the bed of a black pickup truck and a small trailer. They live on 5 acres in Alanson. Here's Terry.
We got hit real hard. We've been out here, I think this is our 10th double trip down here.
Wow.
In 3 days. And we're just having a ball doing this.
Utilities were busy clearing debris from power lines, and it was up to local emergency management teams and road commissions to figure out what to do with debris piling up around right-of-ways along the road and on private land. So some set up these drop-off sites where people can bring branches and trees that were damaged or destroyed by the ice. Lindsay Walker with Emmett County Recycling says they normally contract a company to grind wood people drop off into wood chips. They were able to pivot pretty quickly to accepting more wooden debris. And they have a lot of it.
We have to justify mobilizing these very expensive grinders and haulers of this material. And so every 2 years, we're normally grinding our wood waste. We need to have about 5,000 cubic yards on the ground at any time. And now we've got about 10 times the amount of that.
Some established drop-off sites have been open 24/7, receiving debris by truck, trailer, and even dump trucks.
Having sites that are free and ample space for the public to bring debris is really important. So this site has plenty of capacity for further debris. And then once we get that material ground, then we're hauling. And so there's this process of cleaning up sites as they go along. And this is like us doing the best that we can with the resources that we have.
Some of it will go to landscapers to use as mulch, but they're also selling it to biomass facilities nearby, which will turn that wood into electricity.
I like to use the little saying that we were green before green was cool. So we've been in the renewable power business for a long time.
Tom Clift is the director of biomass operations at North Star Clean Energy, a company that runs four such facilities, including one in Grayling. North Star is one of the places buying and burning that wooden debris from the storm to turn into electricity. In all, the facility powers up to 38,000 homes. Clift says they're not going around and cutting down trees to produce power.
Any wood product that we use here was either going to be left on the forest floor to turn into methane and be released on its own, or it's other materials that would have gone to the landfill.
Dealing with debris after natural disasters is something other areas of the country have been trying to figure out as well, like places in the southeast hit by Hurricane Helene. But officials say this is an unusual issue in northern Michigan, which hasn't typically had to deal with the same kinds of disasters. Brent Sondren is a professor at Ohio State University who studies the economics of forestry. He says generally, in situations like this, biomass is considered a carbon-neutral energy option.
You're talking about residues from an ice storm. And, you know, these are going to be basically, you know, what else would you have that material, use that material for?
Public health researchers and environmental groups have raised alarms about biomass for years. They've pointed to pollution from facilities, health issues, and harm to nearby communities. They've also criticized framing biomass energy as carbon neutral and say we should focus on other things like solar. And dead and dying trees provide a wide range of benefits. Benefits, Sondren says, should be considered before removing them.
There's, you know, huge numbers of, you know, bugs that, you know, we'll basically use that wood material for growing themselves. And then there's animals or birds or other kinds of things that'll use the bugs for their own life cycle. And, you know, it's really important that, you know, we can't just take all of the dead material out of a forest and expect a forest to function well.
Some drop-off sites will be open until things slow down a bit. It's also been a dry spring so far, and the Michigan Department of Natural Resources has some restrictions on burning in place and advises people to check on conditions and burn permits in their area. But what about the timber industry? Couldn't they use all this wood? One road commission official told IPR they reached out to people in the industry. The only reply they got so far was from a lobbying group who said the wood chip market is flooded.
Izzy Ross reports for IPR through our partnership with Grist. Spring is in the air. For us in northern Michigan, it means the return of songbirds and wildflowers. For me, the longer, warmer days bring about a sunnier mood. But for those who experience homelessness, the change of seasons can feel more complicated. Safe Harbor is a shelter in Traverse City, and for years, it has been seasonal, closing its doors at the end of April. But on May 1st, the lights stayed on and the doors stayed open. As IPR's Claire Keenan-Kurgan tells us, Safe Harbor is now just a few steps away from staying open year-round.
Brad Gerlach is the facility manager and volunteer coordinator of Safe Harbor. It's his sixth year working here.
We have 74 beds overall when we get in.
Normally, on April 30th, he would have shown up at 5 a.m. to clean and pack everything away until the following October. The feeling that day, usually?
Sad doesn't really even begin to describe it. There are a lot of tears and a lot of hugs because nobody wants to go.
He said that was hard each year, to send people out, many of whom didn't have another place to go. Many ended up camping in places like the Pines, a wooded area of Traverse City near Division and 11th Streets.
You know, we would have 70-year-olds going out to camp.
But none of that happened this year.
It was shocking just to walk in. Same morning as normal.
Safe Harbor is still waiting for the city to vote on May 5th to decide whether to extend their permit through the summer. For now, they can stay open until at least May 15th. And Gerlach is optimistic, since it was the city that asked them to stay open year-round in the first place.
IPR's Claire Keenan-Kurgan. It is time for a break. When we come back,
why is our arts contributor climbing into haylofts? What's the angle here, Joe?
The answer, in a moment. Stay with us.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
Archaeologists researching the prehistoric Great Lakes are following an unusual guide, AI caribou, digital animals that roam in a virtual Lake Huron as it was 9,000 years ago. You can meet these researchers, see the caribou, and hear about discoveries they've made in the real world using artificial intelligence. That's at Denos Museum on May 15th at 7. Find event information at denosmuseum.org or check out our events page at interlochenpublicradio.org.
Welcome back to the Up North Lowdown. I'm Ed Ronco. One of my favorite parts of driving around northern Michigan is getting to see old barns. I have loved them since I was a kid. One old barn on the Old Mission Peninsula received a big honor this past year. Our arts contributor Joe Beyer talked about it with IPR's Dan Wanchura.
Long before sliding barn doors and salvaged barn wood became the hit of indoor-outdoor architecture, they were just functional planks and walls that let out the livestock, allowed the tractors to be parked inside for the night, or stored the season's produce. Here up north, we love our barns, and we love preserving and protecting them too. And one of those historic barns received quite a big honor this past year. And here to tell us more about it is IPR's arts contributor, Joe Beyer. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Dan.
So I got to ask, why is our arts contributor climbing into haylofts? What's the angle here, Joe?
Well, I hope this is a story about architecture, one of the core visual arts in our world, and also about regional history and the people that keep that history alive. And finally, maybe it's a roadmap for a road trip if anyone simply enjoys the stout beauty of the barns in our landscape. Mm. And as you mentioned, we've got barn mania here that's pretty unique. You can experience it almost everywhere, and usually it's free.
You know, I can see that now that you've sort of pointed that out with, you know, icons like the restoration of historic Barnes Park in Traverse City to, you know, all the barns preserved at Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore. Joe, I was married in a barn up in Charlevoix, believe it or not. So maybe I'm seeing barns everywhere or just noticing them again,
well,
I guess.
There you go. That happens. Barns are definitely everywhere in the visual arts. They've long been adored in landscape paintings and photography. And I guess when you step into a barn, you're sort of stepping into a whole world inside a building. It's a small ecosystem of wood, air, moisture, and light.
Now I'm thinking of all the movies with those spikes of sunshine poking through the barn walls, and it's a little hazy, and you know, hayloft romances or John Ford shadows and silhouettes in the frame of a barn door. Pretty epic.
That was really well done. You hit all the classics in the barn mythology toolkit, Dan. Here in Michigan, I tried to come up with a number, but there are actually so many historic barns that a final estimate's never been reached, but it's definitely in the thousands. Okay. And there's a group called the Michigan Barn Preservation Alliance, which was founded in 1995, and they do a ton of barn advocacy and resource work.
Okay, and I understand they also put out a Barn of the Year award, Joe. What's that about?
Yeah, it's a friendly sort of battle of the barns, I guess. It's a pretty big honor. Each year, barns are nominated in different categories, and then they go through a vetting process. But there are just over about 100 of these barns in total that have ever received the honor, and it's been going on for 3 decades. The barn we're talking about today won in the Family Agricultural Division, which is for working farms.
I saw photos of this barn, Joe, and you know, true to form, it is that classic red color you'd probably want if you had a barn.
Yeah, that sort of burnt brick tone, I learned, comes from homemade paints, where farmers took common materials like linseed oil, which they extracted from flax, mixed it with milk, and then iron oxide, which they found in the dirt and the ground, and that created that classic red color. But it also proved to be a great long-term preservation agent for wood, which is why so many barns are still standing today.
No way.
Yeah.
That is so fascinating. So a barn on the Old Mission Peninsula recently won an award, and you caught up with a family that still operates it.
Yeah, lots of people know the Old Mission Gazette, which is sort of a required reading. It's a newsletter and website out there.
Sure.
And the woman who runs it is Jane Bursaw. And she wrote a story that highlighted this particular barn and the award. And then through reading the story, I found out just how personal this connection was to her. So I reached out and asked her if I might be able to take a tour.
Okay, and Joe, is there a name of, do people name their barns?
Yeah, this barn is known by the family name that's longest and most associated with it, and okay. I found out that's how barns are named and referenced. So this one is known as the Dean and Laura Johnson Barn.
Okay.
It's deceptively massive from Center Road. It has multiple levels, tack rooms, cattle stalls, tractors stored in there, and there's even a secret barn within the barn that I won't spoil for anybody. By the best records here, Dan, we can say this particular barn started in the mid-1800s with a large stone foundation, probably a silo or a cistern, and then it was built with milled lumber, which was kind of rare in the early 1900s. So it sits on a hill on 80 acres of farmland right off Center Road, and it has a unique quilt artwork on the side as well.
And it's been in the same family for six generations, is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's an astonishing connection and a huge motivation, obviously, to keep it going. So about 5 years ago, they made some pretty big renovations. There was a new roof added, the addition of some metal siding, electrical, some brand new huge barn doors. But as you know, when you restore a barn, you do not make it flawless. In fact, just the opposite. Great barns are filled with these idiosyncratic imperfections. That's part of the charm and the patina of the place.
Oh, totally. Any old license plates nailed into the walls to cover up some of those holes?
Oh, definitely. And then if the hole was round, you could use the top of a tin can,
there
that kind of thing. As we did walk through, it was fascinating to see all of these different names and dates carved into the rock and the wood. There were accounts of the crops and the yields penciled into the paneling. And all of those details and the little tokens from history, it really makes exploring a barn kind of unexpected and fun. So Laura Johnson and Jane Bursaw met me on a crisp Saturday morning, and here's our audio tour of the barn.
Hi.
Good morning.
You must be Joe.
Yeah. Hi. You're Laura?
I'm Laura.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
And Laura, you're the co-steward of this barn?
Yes, my husband Dean is the main person.
And this is your sister-in-law, Jane?
This is Jane.
I'm Jane Bursaw. I grew up in this barn and had my horse here, so many memories.
So let's walk around. We'll just take a look.
Okay.
So we're looking in the main part of the barn, which has a huge wall with all of the agricultural equipment and gear and saddles and ladders and all of the things that you've probably found or collected over the years. And then on this wall, we have almost a museum of sorts. There are photographs, there are artifacts. You have your Barn of the Year award. How many barns get one of those?
It was exciting. It was, there's over a dozen, I believe, that were nominated. And then we got the award for family agriculture use.
And that just means that this is still a functioning barn. So in addition to all its history, it still has to do its job, right?
Yes.
It strikes me, honestly, as a bit of a work of art. And I guess after more than 100 plus years of keeping it going, and it's a building no one knows who built it. It doesn't have an architect. It doesn't have one designer. It's changed over the years. But what do you think it is about keeping these historic barns going?
I think people just love the nostalgia of, you know, farming and working hard to make a living, you know, off the land, which not a lot of people do anymore. So I don't know, just keeping the barn going is like a testament to all the hard work that has been done here over the years.
I like the feeling of space. I can look around and almost see stories, you know, or feel stories.
Oh, that was fun, Joe. That was the Dean and Laura Johnson barn. I'm wondering, you know, what can listeners do if they find themselves catching barn fever now after hearing that audio?
Sure. Well, this is the place to have it. All you need to do really is just drive around, especially on Old Mission Peninsula. There are actually so many historic barns concentrated there that they have a barn tour that you can take. Evelyn Johnson, a local who is very passionate about this history, she actually wrote a book, and I counted 67 featured Old Mission Peninsula barns in it. So that's a great reference. And then also, if you want to get your hands dirty, there are some volunteer opportunities to help restore some of these historic structures. So many things you can do.
And we'll link to all of that with our web post for this piece at interlochenpublicradio.org. Joe, before you go, what's the future for this barn?
Well, they say that a barn only lasts if it's built on a great foundation. And this one is literally and spiritually got a great foundation with the family behind it. So we'll see. I just love coming down
to this old barn. Do you think this barn will still be around in 100 years?
It's a long time.
I think if people continue to maintain it, it for sure can go the distance. You caught me running
from the rain. IPR arts contributor Joe Beyer talking with Dan Wanchura. We will stay on the Old Mission Peninsula for a few more moments, but we're moving out of the barns and into the growing fields. Pollination is an essential part of plant reproduction. Birds, bees, and other bugs carry pollen from flower to flower in their pursuit of that sweet, sweet nectar. Most of us know this. But what you might not know is that many of the honeybees here in northern Michigan are actually from Florida. IPR climate reporter Izzy Ross went to a farm on the Old Mission Peninsula to follow one beekeeper placing hives in a cherry orchard on a rainy afternoon.
Let me get you a veil just in case so you don't get stung, because they're going to be flying a little bit.
Okay.
They shouldn't sting you, but they were flying when I put them on the truck a little bit. My name's Michael Peterson. I'm based out of Traverse City, East Bay. I've worked for Hilbert's Honeybees. I'm out here spreading out beehives for the lunch farm.
Could you describe kind of the operation, like the truck and then what you're doing?
Well, yeah, I run a flatbed Class B truck with a Hummer B trailed behind it. It's a pretty much a forklift on steroids. And we load the beehives on pallets, and they either stack two or three high on my truck, and I put pallets on top so the lids don't blow over, and they just hit the road.
Why bring the bees to different places?
Oh, just because the wild honeybees aren't really around much. You got some butterflies, the monarchs, and the bumblebees. But it's just another extra pollination to ensure the farmer.
Is it possible to see inside the hive?
I can kind of crack it a little bit. Let me, I can't open it all the way, but
it is windy.
Yeah. The weatherman ain't right.
Wow. Wow. They're like packed in there.
Yeah.
So they're pollinating the cherry trees here?
Yes. As you can see, they're not quite ready. By next week, you'll start seeing them kind of popcorn out of their shell and have white buds coming out. So this is about the right time. But as you can see, the rain don't stop me. They have to go in a certain time so they can get acclimated to their surroundings.
How long have you been doing this kind of work?
18 years now. It's a family-owned business. My brother-in-law's great-grandfather, he's fifth-generation beekeeper. I learned from the best, I feel.
When did you start getting into beekeeping and, you know, doing this?
Really, I was in between jobs, and I wanted to work outside, and I don't like a closed-in environment.
We're definitely outside right now.
Yes, yes. And the view's amazing. I mean, if you just walk over the peak over there, you can see the bay on that side. There's some places where you can see on the bay both sides while I'm putting in bees. It's really beautiful out here. I mean, I'm always get excited when I have to put bees in the cherries.
Yeah.
And it's always a crunch time because we're based out of Florida too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to get back down there so we can move back up here. And it's my second trip driving down and back. So yeah, we rear queen bees down there. We also do watermelon pollination.
In Florida?
Yeah.
This is a regular thing, so every spring you
guys
bring up?
Yes, every spring I have a list of pollinations to do, and I'm almost done with this one. We do pollination up 31 and all the way up north of Northport. We try to stay in local, try to help the local farmers. We also do almond pollination in the wintertime in California. Or the bees travel more than we do.
That's beekeeper Michael Peterson talking with IPR's Izzy Ross, whose work comes to us through a partnership with Grist. Hey, speaking of pollination and growing things, let's check in now with Dylan Kulik and our recurring segment, Grow and Tell.
Welcome back to Grow and Tell, IPR's guide to gardening with the seasons. My name is The Sneezins. The Sneezins. Sorry. Welcome back to Grow and Tell, IPR's guide to gardening with the seasons. My name is Dylan Kulik, and today we're going to talk about where to plant our plants in the garden for the best success. So we're not planting our tomatoes yet because it's early May and it's still a little bit too chilly, but today we're going to think about where to plant them and then pick what we'll eventually feed them. All right, I've picked a spot in our hoop house. These tomatoes want a lot of sunlight. So pick a spot that gets a lot of sunlight. Maybe it's sheltered from the wind, so your plants aren't getting whipped around in the wind. And of course, easy access to watering close to your hose. That's probably my top recommendation. All right, let's switch gears now and think about what we're gonna feed our plants. In this case, it's fertilizer. And it's really important to add a little bit of fertilizer here in northwestern Michigan because the soil is so sandy, the nutrition that the plants have access to is constantly draining down out of the root interface. You've got a couple options. Today we're going to talk about what might work best for you. So in one hand I have this synthetic fertilizer, and in this other hand I have some organic fertilizer. Now these are both all-purpose fertilizers, which means they have all of the nutrition that's vital to grow plants. The only difference is that one is organic and one is synthetic. Now what does that mean exactly? Synthetic fertilizers, through a myriad of chemical processes, we are able to get nitrogen and other plant ions that are very, very available to the plants, but they don't really do that much for our soil. They just feed the plants directly. If you want instant results, you can add some synthetic fertilizer and you see your plant grow very, very quickly. Now, organic fertilizer is made of naturally occurring substances. This one is composed of bone meal, feather meal, and blood meal, which sounds a little weird, right? That's kind of gross. I wouldn't eat that, but it's really, really good for the soil. So I'm just going to get a scoop of soil right here, and we'll talk about who else is being fed by organic fertilizers. So roots give nutrition to the plants, right? And that nutrition comes from the soil. Well, by adding organic fertilizers, we do feed the plants eventually, but really who we are feeding more directly are the soil microbiological communities, which is a really fancy way of saying tiny life in the soil. The springtails and the rotifers and the earthworms and the fungi and the mold and the yeast, and all of those organisms are going to create a soil ecosystem that is very, very suitable for plant growth, and your tomatoes and your other plants are going to excel in that ecosystem. For all these reasons, I really prefer using organic fertilizers. I am an organic fertilizer guy. That's my choice. But I know plenty of people who prefer synthetic fertilizers because it gives you results fast. But again, by using this synthetic fertilizer, you're feeding the plant directly and you're kind of leaving the soil itself by the wayside. You're basically like loading this plant up on a bunch of processed sugar so that it grows big and fast versus giving it a rich, nutritious, well-rounded diet. So, you know, I always tell my students, you are what you eat. And in a very similar way, plants are what plants eat. Just think about that. Let that blow your mind a little bit. Seriously though, I'm gonna let you decide. You are the gardener. You get to call the shots in your garden.
That's it for this week. We had contributions from IPR's Izzy Ross, Claire Keenan-Kurgan, Dan Wanshura, Ellie Katz, as well as Joe Beyer and Dylan Kulik. Our producer is Max Copeland. Our music is by Blue Dot Sessions. My name is Ed Ronco. We leave you this week with the buzzing of the bees. Think spring, everyone, and maybe it will actually arrive. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.